Hey everyone, and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave's epic Great Linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. This is the 101st episode, and it's going to cover all Winds of Winter chapters, which take place at the start of the Battle of Meereen. So if you don't want to be spoiled for TWoW, you better tune out now. My name is Bina 007, and I'm your host today, and I am joined for the first time in a while, so it's super excited, by Xander.
Hey, Lord Baron on the forums.
Great to have you back on. Also at a ludicrously early hour on the West Coast, so apologies, by the gorgeous Hannah.
Sleepy baby from the forums. I mean, shadow baby.
And currently sitting next to a sleeping baby, literally, is Matt.
Varley on the forums.
And finally, last but not least, and thankfully out of hospital now, it's Jock.
Hello, I'm on the Jock. You're on the forums.
Okay, great. So today we are covering Barristan 1 from TWoW, Barristan 2, also from TWoW, read at a con, and Tyrion 2 from TWoW. So the first and third of these chapters you can read online. I'll put some links into the show notes, but Barristan 2 obviously is just a summary from a con. The last episode ended with Barristan preparing for battle in the Queen's Hand, or Barristan 4, on July 18th. So that was a proper dance chapter. The Battle of Meereen, we believe, takes place on July 19th, and we kick off with Barristan 1. And I think it's Varley with a chapter summary. Matt, you're on mute if you think you're talking.
Sorry, I wasn't talking. The baby woke up, so I brought her downstairs.
Oh, sorry. Do you need a minute?
So, yeah.
Do you need a minute?
I just ran. No, it's fine. I'm just fat and out of shape, so going down a staircase, you know, wins me. All right, Barristan 1. The trebuchets are throwing dead and bloated bodies into Meereen, trying to spread the pale mare. The bodies are exploding and being relatively just gross, with pieces and fluids falling down on people. Barristan kind of takes inventory of who he has going out with him, what the plan is, communicates that to some of the leaders. He gives a really cool speech about, don't worry about feeling like you're a coward, because that'll happen. Push through it. It's this really good dichotomy of war that George likes to present, that like it's glorious and absurd, he calls it, you know. And then they head out, and the next chapter is the battle.
How did you all feel about this chapter? To me, it was just really well written. I loved every moment of it. I really like Barristan, actually. And this just felt like vintage George. And then I realized he published it in 2013, which probably means it was written in 2012. So it is vintage George.
It's really reflective of George's stance on war and being a pacifist, and like how, you know, the fact that Barristan, like, you know, a committed soldier that we know, it calls war absurd, is, you know, just kind of puts a finer point on it.
I agree. It is just some of his best writing, like in the entire series, especially his speech at the end before the battle. Probably one of the better ones in the entire series, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, actually? Because a lot of major battles we see off screen, some we're present at, but have we ever had a proper sort of commander leading a battle and giving that sort of Lord of the Rings style fourth Aeolingus battle cry before? Because it's really powerful. I thought it was beautiful.
I think Tyrion during Blackwater, when he was attacking the Mudgate, has that kind of rally to arms kind of speech. When George does it, it's quite powerful, I think.
Yeah, for vintage vassals out there, you can find on Duncan, aka Valkyrist's YouTube channel, he has a recording of him reading the speech or reciting it, which is really powerful and very cool. So you should check that out if you ever want to be inspired.
Yeah, really, I just wanted my recap to just run his audio, if possible. So fix that in post.
Were any of you surprised? The only thing I found surprising in this is when one of them is saying, what should we do if we come across Daario Naharis? And he's like, just kill him. And in his POV, he's like, I just don't trust that paramour. I just want him dead. And I was kind of like, oh, shit. You know, like, you know, Sir Grandfather.
I thought they said give him a sword, not put him to the sword.
Shit, have I totally misread that? That is my bad.
Yeah, it was like, give him a sword and put him in charge if I fall. Like, wait a minute. Maybe I misread that. Because that's two very different things.
Xander, we need an independent adjudication.
Okay, I got it. And if we come upon the captain, asked the widower, Dario Naharis, give him a sword and follow him. Though Barristan Selmy had little love and less trust for the queen's paramour, he did not doubt his courage, nor his skill at arms.
Oh my goodness.
If he could die heroically in battle, so much the better.
I feel like I Freudianly misread that deliberately because I have such little time for Dario. And I was like, yes, a grandfather. Just kill that guy.
Your brain just said sword and Dario and just put it together and was like, all right, perfect.
Exactly. Kill him. That's just, I was just internalizing my own fan fiction live during reading it.
I mean, we can only hope he does get killed.
Okay. So any other thoughts on Barristan 1 other than my horrific misreading of Dario Naharis?
I remember the first time I read it being like really overwhelmed by it and not sure what to make of it. And I still feel that way. I feel like without, sometimes with George, do you know how he has like three chapters from different POVs, but they're all about the same event? And I feel like sometimes without that extra bit, some of that doesn't always fall into place for me mentally. It can be hard to picture.
So did you feel better once you had the Tyrion chapter, or do you still feel fuzzy?
I do, yeah. No, I do feel a lot better, but I still am... I just feel overwhelmed by the whole thing. I like all the sample chapters that have come out. I don't know, maybe it's my dyslexia and I feel like it's just, it's so incomplete.
Mm. I don't know.
Tyrion one, that one I think is like crystal clear.
I mean, we are left in the worst of all possible worlds where we kind of think we know the outcome, but we don't. So it's kind of, we've gotten this part, this journey through this battle, but we haven't actually finished it.
Yeah, I mean, in real life, and like when the book comes out, if that ever happens, like it could be that Barristan only gets one chapter and dies in it. But right now we're just like, oh, at least he made it like to the battle and he's like doing his Barristan thing.
Yeah, I hope that he will be around for a while. And I think he might be the person that George keeps alluding to as having like the big plot twist that the show would never be able to do.
I think Barristan needs to be alive at least long enough to see or hear about Aegon and realize he's picked the wrong dragon and then die, because then he'll be, you know,
but I mean,
at his worst.
I totally agree, Xander, except I can't imagine having three fucking POVs in Meereen. Like, someone's gotta go, and it's not gonna be Daenerys, and it's not gonna be Tyrion, hopefully. I think he's just, like, you know, the extra... He's the fat that needs to be trimmed.
Well, do you think maybe once they're all in the same spot, he'll be, you know, kind of pushed back from POV status and just kind of regulated to just the character there?
I think that's the case.
Investigate Fagon for her.
Yeah, I think you're right, Xander. I think that he is the substitute POV basically for Dany. If and when Dany returns, he is no longer POV unless she sends him, as you said, Hannah, on a mission to Westeros. So
then she come or he becomes like Brienne.
Okay, shall we push on to Barristan 2 or anything more in Barristan 1?
I just that he's typical Barristan. He's kind of like condescending to some of the fighters, especially the pit fighters, but I think it's endearing how paternal he is to his trainees. And we saw that in actual Dance with Dragons, how he takes pride in his little trainees.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He really is one of the good guys, isn't he?
Just a lifelong of being misled.
Oh, and then the final insult to discover that he's misled. Or Dany versus Fagon. I'm hoping he has a really, really tragic end in these
books. You want him to have a tragic end, not heroic, not a noble?
I just think that would be more George. Because, you know, George is quite cynical, isn't he, about these people who, like Ned, who are honourable and are in service to the realm. And I feel that it would be more in keeping with the spirit of A Song of Ice and Fire if this truly noble, basically decent guy who lived his whole life in duty and service would ultimately realise it's for naught. Right. I mean, of course, I personally would love him to go out. I mean, to a certain extent, I feel that, you know, if Dany kind of flies back into this battle... And he dies saving her life, so saving the life of someone that he truly believes is worthy to be queen, that would be a great heroic end for him, and that's kind of my preference. But I think there's all sorts of beautiful ironies about him as Xander said, realizing that Fagon's on the scene, and I don't know, there's various permutations. But I don't think George is going to give him the end that we would necessarily want for him.
Yeah, I mean, I could see him being a showcase for against like blind loyalty, because, you know, he's, since we've got his POV, he's looked back and thought about like, oh, if I only unhorsed, you know, Rhaegar, like we could have been avoided. Like, you know, if he didn't go into Duskendale, like the Aerys wouldn't have gone completely loco. You know, I think that he's already done enough through blind loyalty to show like how it can backfire that I don't. Well, I guess what he deserves, what I think he deserves, I guess doesn't matter. But I would think that he has enough instances of where blind loyalty led him wrong that he does. We don't need to be beaten over the head with it again.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Any final rejoinders, Xander or Jock?
Maybe just with Harry's hand or in strategy, because, like, although his strategy seems to be sound from a point of view of, like, Westerosi knights and at least then solid, I think that, like, having, like, the Yankish, the Mirnese like, pit fighters in armor could be a weakness in that it costs them their mobility that they previously had.
I think they're more as, like, a shock troop, right? They're supposed to come out there with fury and just kind of throw everyone off their game. Like, you know, I guess they go through it in Barristan, too, and I guess we could talk about it more, but there's, like, you see the different types of fighters on both sides and where they're disciplined and where, you know, where they're not disciplined. And
do you think that it's shitty or poetic that this is kind of like Dany's first major battle and she's not even there to fight it, and everyone's fighting it basically on her behalf?
Well, I mean, she took Yun Kai and she took Marine and did no fighting herself.
I don't feel like either of those were battles, though, you know?
Yeah, the
trials.
Sex.
What about having sex?
What?
I said those were sex. Like, she just sacked the cities. They weren't actual battles.
Oh,
sack. S-A-C-K, not S-B-S.
She sacks those cities good. Laid them down.
Sacks in the cities. Got it.
Okay, now we have our title for this episode.
Sacks in the cities, goddammit.
Oh, yeah, Vassals of Kingsgrave, keeping it classy as ever. Yeah. But I think you're right, aren't they? They were minor skirmishes where she was massively outnumbered. I mean, if you go into a civilian city, admittedly with a militia or two outside it, and you just go in with a proper war army and take it over, I don't think it's really testing your mettle in battle. And I do fear a little bit for Dany that if she comes back, basically, you know, once the battle has been won for her by Barristan or by Tyrion or by Turncloaks who've turned their cloak, then what really is her reputation? I mean, she's not a commander. I don't know. Do people really follow someone into battle for that? Maybe they do.
Well, I think we get a little glimpse of that kind of psychology from Tyrion when he's talking about him being the master of a Syvas place and how the Grand Masters are also now using real people, just like his father used real people, like would don his armor, sit in the back of the army and watch men die for him, but never like break a sweat, never, you know. I think that, you know, there's a very direct correlation to the leaders, and you know, and that's what made like Robb Stark so different, was he led from the front, and you know, all these other lords are well protected and in the rear, and you know, just make other people do their killing and dying for them.
Yeah, I wonder how it'll affect her reputation going forward. Like, she'll get some stupid nickname like the Absent Queen or something.
Oh, no doubt. George will give her a whole bunch of rando nicknames. The menstruating queen. Yeah, whatever.
the menstruating?
Well, that's what she's off doing, isn't she? I mean, she's off menstruating somewhere in a field, or I don't know. Okie dokie. So after Sir Barristan 1, which was a genuine chapter of Tiwa that was published, we then get to Barristan 2. So this is really weird. He read the two chapters aloud at a con. No one has the text of the second one, but we have a summary. So I'm just reading off a summary that was posted to Westeros.org back in February 2013, so a bunch of time ago. So, Sir Barristan 2, this was about the battle. One highlight was the description of the pit fighters coming out to fight in ridiculous armor, totally unprepared for real battle. One of them, a woman, was nearly naked, dressed in a snake. So I'm pleased to see that the con attendee, that was the thing he fastened on. It also described the herons, the Yunkish slaves on stilts, fighting and not doing very well. And then suddenly lots of ships arrive. Someone notices that there were squids on the ships. Barristan recognized that this means Iron Men. Someone saw that they were fighting against the Yunkai. Barristan didn't know which Iron Men were on the ships, and he first thought maybe Balon. Then he remembers that Balon's dead and wondered if it could have something to do with his son who was living with the Starks, which I guess just shows how completely out of touch Barristan is with what's happening back on Westeros. I know it's weird, isn't it? Why do you think that George didn't publish this as a chapter when the content of it was out there? And how far do you guys think we should treat this as sort of part of the canon, insofar as we treat anything in TWA as part of the canon?
So I think that it goes back to George thinking he was going to be done with Winds, and he would have published this as a proper, you know, chapter. I think that at the point when he read this, he thought that Winds would be out soon enough that it didn't need to be published by itself.
Yeah, and what didn't he read this before he started publishing the preview chapters that not necessarily were against what happened in the show, like around the time or something, but it was before any of that, like before we got the Sansa chapter or the Arya chapter?
Yeah, the Barristan one was early, wasn't it? And I kind of feel like, having published Barristan 1, why not just publish Barristan 2? It just feels weird to me that he just stopped there. I mean, it's not a big deal, but I find it odd you'd have one and not the other. Unless maybe he was by then in the point of editing and condensing down his description of Battle of Meereen, and he didn't know if it was going to survive in its form, which I can imagine. Like, you can imagine the events conveyed in that summary being shown from a Victorian POV instead. So...
Oh, fuck, I forgot about that nonsense. There's another, some fat that can be trimmed out of a Marine POV.
Yeah. That's when he was saying there were three Marine POVs potentially with Danny. It was like, but what about Victorian? Or are we just retconning him out of history? You could think of the Battle of Slaver's Bay as a separate battle, though, I guess, technically. The naval battle. But yeah, he's there too.
Ah, boy.
He'll burn bright and fast, though.
Yeah, I don't know how bright he is.
Hot and fast.
There we go.
Okie dokie. Any other thoughts on Barristan 2 insofar as there are?
So there's they kind of describe everyone and everyone's fighting styles. Like you said, the pit fighters are absurd. I think that also the Stormcrows start yelling Dario and Stormcrows fly. I think that's absurd as like a battle cry. But then it says that Barristan thinks he'll never again doubt the valor of sellswords. It's just funny because right after that, someone gets hit by like an arrow or a crossbow bolt, and he looks behind him and then like just stares at the sellsword whose tits are hanging out wearing the snake. And like only when he sees someone else go down with a crossbow, he's like, oh yeah, I have to look forward. I thought that was kind of funny.
I used a different source. So in mine, it says that not that she was wearing a snake, but that her only weapon was a python.
How the fuck do you use a python as a weapon? Are you strangling people in it? Are you just randomly throwing it in the crowd to bite people? I mean,
no, it's like James Earl Jones in Conan the Barbarian when he stretches out the snake like an arrow and shoots it. It's like a cartoon, like, you know.
In fairness, I wouldn't put it past George to have a direct Conan the Barbarian reference. I mean, he's very much in that tradition of the sort of the schlock kind of cheap, you know, penny dreadful type fantasy world writing. Are there any other differences in your summary? Anything else that was left out, Jock?
I don't know. It was a fan trying to relight it, so.
Yeah, I think I may have like something, because mine's real long, the one that I read. It describes like the herons were freakishly tall before they were put on stilts, and they wear pink scales and feathers and steel beaks.
Blimey.
So giant birds.
And then there's like the little pigeon and the red lamb are like leaders of those guys. And the red lamb is about to get killed. And he says, or the little pigeon is about to get killed by the red lamb, and the pigeon says, I'll be a big ransom, and the lamb says, I came for blood, not for gold, and then knocks his head off with a mace. Barristan compares to what he's, once he realizes that the krakens are fighting in the water, he realizes that it's like Baylor Breakspear and Prince Makar, the hammer and the anvil. We have them. We have them.
Gosh.
So that's a nice little throwback to Duncan Egg.
Right above that, he's like, oh, I wonder if they've joined with Joffrey. Does he not know that Joffrey's dead? How the fuck would he know that Baylon is dead?
But you heard Baylon, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that if we look at the timeline, they're closer together than we think they are, like within Storm of Swords and Feast of Crows.
But Tyrion, I don't know. I just feel like that news would have spread by now. Or is he just senile?
What, you think the news of what? Of Theon losing Winterfell?
Of Joffrey's death.
Oh, okay.
He's like, Krakens, are they with Joffrey?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense, because doesn't he already know that Tywin is dead?
Yeah.
Yeah, and with everybody, like, to me trying is like to get weird. Tyrion's head.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why George didn't publish this chapter. He's like, no, this makes a fucking sense, time-wise. I gotta revise this.
The Purple Wedding is basically January 300, and we are now July 300, so...
Oh, so that's reasonable. That's, you know, 6 months. Wouldn't did Baylon get killed? Do you have a date on that?
Yeah, 1 second. This is the glory of this brilliant Redditor. Baylon dies. Baylon dies on the 15th of November 299. So it's about 7-8 months before this.
And before Joffrey died.
Yeah, like about a month and a half before Joffrey dies.
What the fuck? That doesn't make no sense.
It's the truth. I'm giving you the truth, dude.
I believe you, I just don't believe this Redditor.
Well, if you don't believe the Redditor, we've got a massive fucking problem with 101 episodes of the book.
all these hours wasted.
We've got a bigger existential crisis on our hands. I think it's actually pretty reasonable that Barristan, who was then, you know, on the run, traveling through Essos to get to Dany, other end of the world, dealing with all the craziness that's going on in Meereen, that news would be sketchy. I mean, if you think back to Storm of Swords, when we've got Rob winning his battles and the comet coming over, the Red Comet, and people are out of touch on news by 3-4 months, and that's just within Westeros. So I think this
because Quentin would have known, right?
Quentin have known? When does Quentin set out? Let me see if I can answer that. When does Quentin leave?
Subtract about like 8 months from when he dies, because he's dead.
And like they'd have spies in that court and stuff like that. I just feel like that's ridiculous.
Stop trolling me, Matt. Quentin leaves.
Never.
Yeah, January. So it's about the same time. Quentin might not know unless Quentin had simultaneous news. It's just about credible that they wouldn't know.
I find that to be, something's up there, because like they'd have to have spies in their courts, and so I feel like that's bad writing then, if that's the case.
Well, when was the last time Meereen had like outside contact, like even with somebody like Illyrio, who would most certainly know? But haven't they essentially been in a lockdown?
Varys has been like back and forth a couple times, right?
No, we haven't seen Varys since he killed Kevin.
Yeah, never. No, he's, that's right.
Yeah, I guess the last contact Meereen had was with Duck Sauce, and then they were,
yeah, that's true.
They were laid siege to. So that was probably like the last time that real information got there. I think they still have riders going up, like, what was it, the Lazari Pass, whatever. Anyway, still,
they must have some sort of spy network, right? Even like a ramshackle, court would have spies in another, don't you think?
I don't think they have the infrastructure. I mean, they barely have control of their own city. Like, I think,
But you don't think that was already in place before Danny even got there? Do you know what I mean? It's just like everyone's got spies. Everybody.
Yeah, but there's a good chance that the spy masters were killed with the regular masters during, like, the takeover.
Maybe.
Yeah, I can fathomably see that they just haven't been in contact or much contact with the rest of the world since they've been busy like dealing with all the infighting and Dany and everything.
I really find it to be kind of crazy though. I mean, I'll drop it, but I just think that sounds wrong. Like even in real world history, you would have had everyone spying on everyone and knowing. Like that kind of news breaks worldwide pretty quick, even in olden times. Even before the internet, I feel like.
I don't
olden times in the books
that use that were thought of as a Catholic army led by a guy called Prester John to defeat the Muslims, and not nomadic people conquering anything they ran into.
Wasn't Prester John a make-believe person?
Yeah, and that's what they thought the Mongols were.
Right, with a city that like flowed with gold and everything else. People are so stupid.
Yes. Yes, they are.
But that's also different, right, Jacques? Like, that's an invasion into a foreign land. That's not a sitting king on his throne in his kingdom is frigging murdered and, like, nobody knows.
Yeah, but it's still the game of telephone that you get in other chapters where it's like the dwarf, like, chopped off Joffrey's head in front of everyone, and like, you know, Sansa turned into a wolf and ran away. Like, you know, it can get really jarbled, like in the communication, and especially when people.
I mean, the long and short of it is that he's dead. Like, that's the highlight, right?
But then with all the other misinformation, you know, there's the doubt that's raised of like, well, if all this other absurd stuff happened around him dying, is he even dead? Which some people will like create their own conspiracy theories and make sure that even though we saw someone die in a, you know, blaze of glory, Bina, that person would still be alive.
I'm not listening.
Some Joffreys. I don't know what to believe. Maybe, or maybe they have spies and they're purposely like, don't tell them, so they don't know what they're really dealing with.
Yeah. I don't know.
That I could see, like, the counter-espionage there. I could see that being an actual reason.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this little chapter summary yielded more than I thought was possible.
So, someone... sorry, I've been reading this comment thread under it, too. Just to get to where we are in the Battle of Meereen, it's Barristan 1, Victarion 1, Tyrion 1, Barristan 2. So, it's going to be, like, 12 fucking chapters before we know like the outcome of the battle, right?
Maybe.
Like we won't know it's like the outcome of the battle till like the middle of the book, cuz he's going to go back to Westeros for a couple of chapters in between.
No, surely he will just cap this off first. Oh. I mean, he's not deliberately sadistic, is he? I mean, like, come on. I was even thinking a prologue, like just have a nice prologue from someone random, as he always does. He just tells us how it all got wrapped up.
Yeah, it'll be the guy who runs in on the horse in Tyrion's chapter. It'll be his prologue, his point of view, and all of a sudden it ends with Barristan. God damn it, what's his name? Jorah cutting his throat.
The death of Daario. Make it slow.
That would be great.
Anyways,
Daario so much
because he's
cool.
No, he's not. I don't even want to get into it. I think we should move on to Tyrion. Okay, so after Barristan 2, we go to Tyrion, who gives us his version of the opening of the battle, and it's Xander reading Drew's chapter summary because sadly, Wargasm is having trouble joining us with clear audio. Over to you, Xander.
All right, so it's my first time reading this summary, so give me 1 second. So Tyrion awakens to the musical theater of war, men yelling orders, distant screams of agony. The sunrise was not the only show in the sky this morning, as Rhaegal and Viserion have their breakfast on the wing, corpses a la trebuchet. Slaver's Bay was a bustle with Carthian galleys giving their first introduction to the Ironborn. He recounts his previous battle experiences as he prepares himself for his third battle and finds his way out of his numb haze and decides he wants to live after all. Even after the things he has done. When he gets back to his and Penny's tent, finding her already fully armored thanks to her prior experience from Mummery, She begins helping him into his armor, and he asks about getting some wine, which he had already drank the night before. He sighs and says, "I would sell my sister for a cup of wine," to which Penny responds, "You would sell your sister for a cup of horse piss." Once armored, he goes in search of wine and encounters Inkpots. They receive a messenger requesting the company to come to the Bayshore and assist the naval forces, which were currently having the shit kicked out of them by the Ironborn. Brown Ben Plum was not there to receive the order, though he was with the commander from the previous rotation. The messenger gets frustrated as his orders are being ignored and leaves. Tyrion tells the Inkpots that they need to turn and rejoin Team Danny, but that's a decision only Brown Ben Plum can make. Eventually, Brown Ben Plum returns and everyone is together in the company wartet, including Ser Jorah. Another rider comes with orders from the commander, Morgar Zerzan. Plum was expecting orders from Gorzak Zoeres, but was killed when the Prince of Tatters turned his cloak along with the company of the Windblown. The messenger recognizes Tyrion, declaring him property of the Yellow Whale, but Brown Ben Plum denies it. He has no collar nor bells. He asked Ser Jorah for his opinion on the matter. His opinion was less expressed in words as it was by thrusting his sword through the envoy's throat. Warmonth holds strong opinions. Brown Ben Plum announces then, "We have always been the Queen's men. Rejoining the Yunkai was just a plot." And then it looks like Drew has some notes, and he says, "So I really struggled to find humor in this chapter, I think in part due to how distasteful the T-Man's character has become." Oh, Tyrion, duh. "The one thing I could not get out of my mind is just the absurdity of the projectile corpses and the dragons feasting on them midair. I mean, some poor fucker shits himself to death, and that's just getting started. Your body then gets hauled to a trebuchet and flung skyward, where they are engulfed in a blaze of dragon fire, then ripped apart down the gullet of a feasting dragon. I would assume since the dragons now eat on the wing, they also shit that way too. So look out for that. Dragons are nothing if not majestic. Also, I decided to look up alternate names for dysentery. Fun ones include Montezuma's Revenge, the Flux, the Trots, Teristas, and my personal favorite, the Aztec Two-Step." Is that for real, Aztec Two-Step?
I think I've done that in Mexico.
We also have the
juice. I love the trot.
We have Deli Belly for people who get the runs when they're in India.
Oh, buddy.
Deli Belly.
In fact, there's a brilliant film, a really funny Indian film, like a modern Indian film called Deli Belly, which is largely in English, but you can get like the subtitles for the Hindi bits, which is very rude and very funny, which is worth watching if you ever get a chance.
Call it the Tijuana Tango.
Yeah.
That's a good one too.
So I have a question on this whole dragon eating diseased bodies thing. I know they do scorch them before they eat them, but if they didn't, or regardless, could the dragons get the pale mare?
I doubt it, but my thing is, do they not like fresh meat though? Wouldn't they just think it's gross?
No, only men and dragons eat cooked meat. That's something that Danny learns and when they're very little.
Well, no, I know the cooked part, but I didn't mean like fresh, like raw. I meant like, I mean, even when you're cooking sickly meat, you still don't want it to be rotten, right?
Cooking rotten meat is still going to smell and taste rank.
Yeah, but you could cook the shit out of it to cook any bacteria or viruses.
Again, I don't eat meat, so I'm not really sure, but do you do that?
Cook the shit out of it? No, I like mine bloody. I'm a true carnivore.
Same.
So
dragons get sick?
That's one thing, right? And then it'd be another to see if it was like, if it's a bacteria or a virus. Is this like really cholera or dysentery or what is this? If it's a virus, then it needs a certain, it would have to mutate to affect other organisms.
Mm. Yeah, and like, do we have anything as far as like dogs roaming around or horses getting it?
I think
they did mention something about the animals getting sick outside of the walls. Before any of the battle, like when Danny went out and was attacked by the one dude, I think they mentioned something about animals getting sick as well, like horses and dogs.
I just thought it might be a nice get out of jail free card for George. You know, he has these ridiculous weapons of mass destruction, and at some point he needs to eliminate some of them to even things up.
And they die from shitting themselves to death?
Come that on. Would be like hilarious from my perspective, because I don't like dragons.
Yeah, that's a good point, Drew. He doesn't cook things that have diarrhea.
As a rule.
As a rule.
This is a VOK PSA. If something has diarrhea, do not kill and cook it and then eat it.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Again, I'm just saying, vegetables don't do such things.
Do you know what gave more people diarrhea over the past year? Probably romaine lettuce.
Oh, no, I know.
Yeah, true.
Facts. E. coli.
The other thing that really freaked me out in this chapter, although, you know, I'm loving Tyrion getting back to his wily ways of manipulating everyone and being a player of the game. But the thing that really freaked me out in this chapter is we've moved through A Dance with Dragons thinking that Tyrion is kind of recovering from the trauma that's at the end of A Storm of Swords and his betrayal by Shae and his murder of his father, and that he's slowly finding himself again and stopping drinking, and Penny's helping him find his humanity again. And then he just goes so dark and so triggered in this chapter, and it really freaked me out. I thought, my God, this is it's only just under the surface, and the wrong thing can trigger him. He nearly he would have murdered Penny if he had a weapon to hand. And it's like, okay, so George is letting us know that as much as he's recovered enough to be a director of battle and to be a player of the game, as soon as he gets back to Westeros and sees his sister or anything, that he can still be a nasty little murderer. And I kind of had forgotten that, how dark he really was.
Yeah, especially like, during Drew's recap, he really didn't touch on this, but like Tyrion thinks back on his first battle, which leads him to remember the first time he met Shae and wondered, you know, like if she was like a mummer back then too. And then like all of a sudden he's remembering like twisting the necklace around her throat. And I was like, oh my God, is that what he's doing to Penny right now? I'm glad that they came back and that wasn't what was happening. But then there's like a ludicrous kiss in this chapter too that I was just like, I don't know. And then you kind of see Tyrion going dark and then being a dick and then coming back and being like, no, like kind of recognizing that he was going to a dark place.
Do you feel like, though, he's more effed up about what happened with Shae and his dad or what happened with Tyshe and his dad? Because, like, I feel like that kind of trauma would confuse
you. I don't think Tyshe was mentioned. I know for sure Shae was. But, I mean, they're basically, like, the same point
in
this
darkness. The whole time he's like, where do whores go? Is really damaging to him to find that information.
I think it's as simple as like the whole situation with Tyshe and his father and everything. It's kind of just the root of all of Tyrion's issues as an adult. So even if he doesn't reference it, that's still the like his baseline of mistrust and dislike, I guess.
Yeah, before Jaime sets him free, but then after, it's so much worse finding out what really
Tyrion
happened.
Sucks.
Hey, yeah, he's had a hard time.
I am curious.
He's working through shit.
A bit like Arya, right? And we're coming up to the Mercy chapter, but all these people who have really loved and stand Tyrion from the beginning, how do they reckon? What would have to happen to Tyrion? How dark does he have to get for them to think, shit, he sucks, in the words of Sandor?
I don't think he sucks. I think that he's just all fucked up.
Yeah,
he really is. Imagine this, like, imagine being in love with somebody and then finding out that it was all a ruse, that your brother and your dad played a trick on you and she was really a whore. And then you're forced to watch while a bunch of guys hump her and then you have to finish it off. Like, and she's the Limp Bizkit there. Then you find out right after you've killed your other girlfriend.
He didn't have to finish it off. That's the thing that always gets to me about that story.
But do you know what I mean? Like, that manipulation is just so fucked.
Right. And, yeah.
I think
and I agree.
The darkest
like,
thing George has ever written, personally.
And as Drew points out, then you find out she actually did love you. Sorry, Xander.
Correct.
No, I was just saying, like, yeah, I agree. Like, everything Tyrion has been through is absolutely horrible. And I wouldn't wish it upon anybody. But I I'm biased because I never liked Tyrion in the first place. So even just getting to
shut your face, when really?
No, I've never liked him.
Okay, we need to get into this now, Zanza, because I kind of agree with you, and it's a little bit the opinion that can never speak its name. It's like not being into Arya. So, what is it about Tyrion that you just don't jive with?
So like as funny and smart and yes, lovable he is. I don't know. Whenever I read him, I don't know if it's just like because he's part of the aristocracy, so he's kind of just like a spoiled trust fund kid who can get away with whatever just because his dad's Tywin Lannister, or I don't know. I can't necessarily pinpoint it, unless maybe what I can do someday is just go through a Tyrion reread and just start writing down everything I don't like about him.
Yeah, we wouldn't inflict a reread on you on just the character you hate. But I think it is really interesting to hear these diverse opinions, because I think in so much of our community, it's kind of felt that Arya and Tyrion are the sort of characters that everyone loves, are the cheeky chappies, are the kind of clever outsiders. And as dark as they get, as dark as George takes them, people can forgive them almost anything, because, hey, they're messed up and they went through this stuff, which is fair enough. And yet with my girl Sansa, like, she does some stupid shit when she's like a preteen romantic delusionist and can never be forgiven for that. So I think it's kind of interesting to see how fan communities treat different characters. But that's just me.
What is it that you think Tyrion's done that's so unforgivable, though?
Oh, it's not that I think that anyone, no one's beyond redemption, right? Like, Jaime's not beyond redemption. It's more that I don't think people understand just how dark he's gotten, and I think it's going to be really interesting if he ends up doing some... I mean, he's already killed Jay and his dad, and I mean, that's pretty harsh, right?
To me, that is like a crime of passion that I understand. Well, his dad, I feel like, is an act of self-defense almost. Shay was...
Huh? He was sitting on the loop, wrapping himself to bring it. Right. I mean, yeah. This is the poop
long
episode.
Run of his life, though, it really is him or Tywin.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and then Drew's saying the rape is what I can't get over. Off Penny, I'm saying. And I agree. I think he was the rich trust fund kid. If he did not want to rape Penny, yeah, they might have mocked him, but he could have away with not... He could have...
Wait a minute, he raped Penny?
Not Penny, you know what I mean. The first wife.
Oh, Tysha.
Tysha.
Okay.
See, and to me, the one I can't get over is the singer's stew. I think that's the worst thing he's ever done.
Yeah, that poor guy was just singing.
Correct.
He got thrown into a pot of stew.
Yeah, that is like the most fucked up part of it to me.
I feel that if other characters had done that, we would be saying they were beyond redemption. Like if a Frey had done that, or if a Lannister had done that. But because it's our beloved Tyrion doing it, it's like, oh, but he's been through a lot. And, you know, it's rough being, I feel
it's
a lot.
That's not true. I mean, we talk about Theon and we talk about all the trauma he's experienced, and we can almost understand what he is motivated by when he takes Winterfell and has those two boys killed.
Yeah, but understanding isn't excusing, is it? I mean, I understand why Theon did it. I don't excuse it. And
no, it's not excusing, but we almost have a little sympathy for him, and it kind of is a catalyst. And I think we're supposed to, as the reader, be okay with his sort of redemption arc, and also that he's been punished enough, right? Like, he's kind of done his time now. But I feel like Tyrion's been doing his fucking time since the second he was born, and then he doesn't get the same kind of pass or sympathy at all, and that's weird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think with Theon, it's, you know, you're supposed to pity him, whereas Tyrion, I don't know, maybe George
because,
just
like,
really
he's supposed to be a hero. It's more unforgivable.
I think George just really wanted to show, because Tyrion is his favorite character too, so I think George just really, really wanted to show how uncomfortable it can be when you admire and enjoy a character so much doing heinous things that you wouldn't agree with. And it's almost a manipulation on George's end to kind of have us step back and question why we even like this character in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
We should do probably an episode where we just discuss redemption and sort of fan judgments on characters and how consistent or not we are. I mean, Drew's made the kind of cool point, but yeah, but Jamie can push a boy out of a window. We have weird tolerances as a fandom. And I think you're right, Drew. And I think
yeah,
it
but
is.
Brain is fine.
Yeah, he's up there doing his own thing now.
Or like Job said, it's payback for his future boring chapters.
Yeah, but I think it's all about the arc and where you take them. So Jamie and Theon travel in one direction, which is from being horrific to being redeemed. And Arya and Tyrion are kind of traveling in the opposite direction. And it will be very interesting to see whether they also can be redeemed or whether we just leave them in complete twisted darkness because of what life has done to them, which may or may not be their fault, but it kind of is what it is. And I find that really fascinating. This is why I love these books, right? This kind of character development. But I think there is a sort of inconsistency in how we approach these characters. Anything specifically on Tyrion too, though, in this chapter? And what do you think of all these kind of machinations of the mercenary brigades going back and forth and back and forth?
Well, yeah, that to me, what a different kind of battle this is. Like how you were saying, Bina, earlier, we haven't really gotten this like command POV. I think the closest thing that we get to it is maybe what am I trying to say, in like the world books or in Fire and Blood, the descriptions of what happens, but we don't really get to be there. And then we never seen one where it's like a bunch of paid for armies. The ones we've seen so far in Westeros are all with people that have like ancient familial blood ties to things. They're fighting for their homes and their lands, not for monies. So there isn't that like shifting winds with the coins.
Yeah, well, I mean, there still is, obviously, because we have the situation with the Boltons and stuff. But what I thought was what they were trying to show was like the disruption of Daenerys taking all the Unsullied. But those were only like the pre-graduate Unsullied, right? Shouldn't like all these Grand Masters have like a mini Unsullied army of their own that they had beforehand? I know like they try to make some on the fly, but like I just find it like unreasonable to think that with these types of fighters they were able to hold Slaver's Bay against any other outside force. Like just the fact that Victarion's slaughtering all of them on the shores makes it like they're not. I mean, the Ironborn should have been like kings of Slaver's Bay then, like, you know, if it was that easy. I don't understand what's going on.
It's quite hard to defend from both flanks, which the Unsullied are likely arranging themselves in, and amphibious assaults. The sea people from the Bronze Age destroyed the Hittite Empire, the Assyrian Empire, and the Egyptian pharaohdom or kingdom or whatever it was called. And that was pretty much the entirety of Bronze Age civilization, just by these random group of amphibious pirate people. And as for flanks movements, you have Alexander the Great just rolling over the entire northern world in one of its first uses, and the Romans rolling across much of Western Europe with these.
Egypt wasn't taken over. They were defeated at once, but they repelled them, or else it would have been a separate pharaohdom, right?
After the Bronze Age collapse, and weren't Leoi restored until Leoi Ptolemy, one of Alexander's generals, restored the pharaohdom and integrated himself into the standard set of gods and pharaohs that lasted until Cleopatra and Mark Anthony.
Matt, going back to what you said, like, well, we have the Boltons. I still feel like that is different. That's not as much about money as, again, like bloodline and seats, right? At a table that they're already at. They're just trying to switch seats. The motivation
it's always about money.
I don't think so. Really, you think that of the Boltons?
Absolutely. Why else would they want to be kings of the North? It's money and prestige.
In that sense that like everything has to do with money, obviously, but I still feel like it has a lot more to do with the prestige part of it. And because again, it's like their homeland. None of these people are fighting for their homeland. They're literally just like at work. And that is a different type of battle. It's a different type of fury you bring to the situation and stuff. a different way of fighting. Not that necessarily like one is superior or anything. It might be better to be cool and calculating and not care that much. But it's interesting because in those battles, it's like, no, I fight for House Bolton. You just don't like, oh, well, Lord Stark waved his hand at me, so I'm going to go over there. But these guys do. They're like, oh, somebody's got a bigger purse over there. Let's go. I would never want to fight with this House Sword Company or like have them fight for me because of that. They could just as easily turn on you.
Yeah, and I think that's basically our first taste of the sellsword companies are they're disliked in general. Like we have the Bloody Mummers in Westeros, and they turn right against Tywin, and it just kind of proves their point about how disloyal they are. And once we get into Meereen and these chapters, they show even how more disloyal. You know, with Daario switching sides immediately, and then Brown Ben switching sides against Daenerys, and
But are these sellsword companies really following money, or are they following their own neck?
Good point.
I think. Well, the Tattered Prince was promised Pentos, right? If he turned his cloak, so that's money and power and prestige in Pentos. Brown Ben Pum reads the tea leaves and switches sides, so that's for his neck, you know. It was probably money that turned him against Daenerys, you know, once she. Or, I don't know. Maybe it was his neck both times, because once he learned that she wouldn't use the dragons, he's like, oh, you're going to lose then, and better save my butt.
Anything else on the chapter?
I think it's just a little hard, because they are still just preview chapters. So we don't really have, like, the full context we could get into. A lot of it's just speculation.
And maybe they may not even exist in the book at all.
Like, can I ask a meta question? Would you rather not have these at all than have them in this kind of weird purgatory format where you don't even know if they're going to make it in?
I would rather have them. I enjoy them. I can see why some people don't want to bother, don't want to know about them. Like, and I see that point of view too. I feel like if he was releasing books every couple years, 2-3 years, then I probably wouldn't want to read the preview chapters. But, you know, during these long droughts, it gives us a little bit of just enough to whet our appetite.
Yeah, and I do enjoy, because it happened in one of the earlier books, a preview chapter was at the end of it. And then when it's actually published, you can actually see all the edits and changes that are made. So you kind of, I like that because you kind of get to see more of the thought process of what George is doing in these books and what he's trying to convey.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, as a look at the process, it's interesting. I agree.
He's conveying that he's a nihilist and we should all too. That's what I'm getting out of it so far.
I mean, he's a nihilist in writing, but by all accounts, he's a hippie as a person.
Aren't they the same thing?
I think he's more like a
hippie. Oh, take that.
I just like the proof that George is working. This isn't proof that George is working, Drew. This is proof that George was working in 2012.
That's what I'm saying. he did work. He did at least 4 chapters or 5 chapters. However many preview chapters are worth of work.
So hey, he's working. He still complains about football.
Aww. He hasn't really. Because I guess the Jets and Giants just suck so bad he didn't even have time. Hopefully that means he was writing, but I just checked his website just to, you know, because I'm a sadist and no updates.
Well, before we descend into a true George Wallow, I feel maybe we should end it here unless anyone's got anything specific they want to say about the Tyrion 2 chapter or any of these chapters. Nope. Well, with that, I want to thank Matt. I want to thank Xander, Jock, and Hannah for joining me, and I want to commiserate for all of VOC listenership that Drew couldn't quite make it on because it's so sad. Oh dear. And to let you all know that the next chapters of the reread, the next episode, is back to Winterfell for the first time in ages. And I think we can all breathe something of a sigh of relief about that. So the chapters are The Sacrifice, Usher 2, so Arnulf Karstark joining Stannis. Then we have A Ghost in Winterfell, Theon 6, which is the trial of Theon, Mors Umber arrives. And then Theon 7, where Theon and Jaime escape, and the Iron Banker Tyjo is approaching Winterfell. So really awesome chapters next time. Hope you can all tune in. Well, with that, thank you all so much for joining. This was a weird all tea well all the time episode. Xander, it was really cool in particular to podcast with you again after a little while. And I'm really looking forward to listening to the next one because it's going to be good to get back into Winterfell. Anyway, have a lovely weekend, everyone. Speak to you all soon.
Now, wait.
Bye. Hey!
Hey!
Live from Vassals of Kinsgrave, we bring you a special guest. Back from Volantis, wherever he's been hiding. It's Drew! Dude, you on?
What is going on? Your voice
Fucking
is
hell, that is some shitty audio.
I know, I'm just...
Do you not have headphones in? Because I can hear Bina's echo in your microphone.
Oh, I do.
And what's going on? Maybe my microphone's still
It's
on.
also robotic as well. I can hear echo. Say something, Drew.
It sounds like Drew's booting up.
It sounds like some 80s kind of sci-fi movie. I'm getting like doo 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 like.
Yeah.
It's the Skynet.
Yeah.
Yeah, Drew just hard restarted and he's like, burr, 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 burr. I
Our
have to come back to life.
cyborg overlords are coming to get us.
So Drew joined the Borg, and that's where he's been.
I assume so. I mean, I'm not hating it as a sort of experimental music vibe.
Yeah. It's like, oh crap, what's that machine where you put the wands over it and it makes like weird
Yes.
psychedelic noises?
Pyramid.
Pheramid. Oh my goodness.
It's definitely not.
I heard two like clear words from Drew and was like, hey.
Well, that voice loves it.
That was a vibe.
And that was it.
Okay.
All right.
Well, let's carry on
Well,
discussing the chapter and hopefully he can jump in with
okay.
it.
Oh boy, what's going on? Maybe it's a call.
Do you want me to restart the call?
Yeah.
We can hear
Who's
you,
speaking?
Drew, but it's really robotic and with a lot of feedback.
Well, now that almost sounds English, but still
He said,
robotic.
"Hold on, let me see." I feel I heard actual words forming, so this is an improvement.
It's going to be a real bummer to subtitle a podcast.
Yeah.
Subtitles read just arpeggiated noises.
Yeah.